thus putting a lead screen over any bug and making it undetectable, and for the moment, unable to see and hear. But when the probe was off, the screen would be off, and any bug or device could see and hear. So far, so good. They now went on an extensive tour of the storerooms, telling Lars, who showed up, that they were looking for spindle buffers, and located not only every other bug probe in the compound, but also every other key component it took to make a bug probe. They put these in a box and put the box in their car to be transported out of the country. They now had a probe that wouldn't probe, while obviously working, and 15 irises they could put in front of bug devices. Lars popped up again, saying they sure were quiet, and they told him to get lost. But presently, Kerr took a disc recording of hammering and pounding and drilling and let it play. They cleaned up traces of their work so far and hid their products. Suddenly, they realized it had been a long day. They hadn't eaten. They had a long way to go, but that, they agreed, was enough for now. Johnny and Angus, not wanting to tempt the fates by running into too many cadets at the academy, elected to bed down in Char's old quarters. Kerr was going to drive back to the academy and get them something to eat, and bring them some work clothes. Donald Dean should be there now, and Johnny had a message for him about the cyclos. Johnny typed it out on Chirk's writing machine. All's well. In 3 days, engineer the transportation of the 33 P's, now in compound jailhouse, to stated destination Cornwall. Report them crashed at sea. Deliver to the doctor. Not before 3 days. You will have no trouble with them. They'll be screaming to leave. Eat this note. Kerr said he'd deliver it and rushed away. Johnny and Angus stretched out to unwind. So far it was okay. They had a ways to go. 2. A bit lost in Char's 12-foot bed, a bit tense in this echoing empty compound, Johnny was waiting for Kerr's return. It was getting very late, and he was wondering what the delay might be. But to pass the time, he was reading. Char, in packing, had tossed out odds and ends that he hadn't cared to take back to Cyclo with him, and one of them was a Cyclo infant's History of Cyclo, maybe from Char's own early schooling, for it said under the cover leaf, in an immature scrawl, "Char's book. You stole it, so give it back." And then, below that, "Or I'll claw you." Well, Char wouldn't claw anybody now. He was dead, by Turl's thrust, quite a time now. Because Kerr had mentioned underground mines, Johnny was mildly interested to learn that the whole of the Imperial City on Cyclo, and all the surrounding area, was a maze of deep and abandoned shafts and drifts. As long as 300,000 years ago, Cyclo had exhausted surface minerals and had developed semi-core techniques. Some of the shafts went down as far as 83 miles, and in some cases, that was within half a mile of the liquid core. How awfully hot those mines must have been. They could only be worked by machines, not living beings. The labyrinth was so extensive that it caused some buildings on the surface to sag from time to time. He was just reading about the First Interplanetary War to end mineral starvation when Kerr came back. Kerr looked a bit grave, even through his face mask. "Donald Dean's been arrested," he said. Donald Dean, related Kerr, had arrived in a battle plane just at sunset and had gone to find quarters and supper. As he came out of the mess hall, 2 men in monkey skins with cross belts stepped out of the shadows and told him he was under arrest. A squad of several more were at a distance. They had taken Donald Dean in a ground car driven by Lars up to the big Capitol building, the one with the painted dome up in the ruined city. They pushed him into the courtroom, and the senior mayor Planet started to charge him with a whole lot of crimes, like interrupting council projects and committing war, and had then looked at him more closely and said, "You're not Tyler," and had called for the guard captain, and there'd been a row. Then this senior mayor made Donald Dean promise not to incite a war with Scotland over this, and had let him go. Donald Dean was back at the academy after taking Lars's car away from him, and he was all right. Kerr had had to wait to give him the message, and Donald Dean said to warn Johnny. "It means," concluded Kerr, "that they expected you to come in,
and they've got their eyes out all over the place. We gotta work fast, be careful, and get you out of here as soon as we can."
Johnny and Angus ate a bit of the food Care had brought, and then went to sleep for 4 hours. Care had turned in his old room, sleeping in a breathe mask, for there was no breathe gas circulation in the general compound. They were at it again before dawn, working fast. Care had another disc recording of hammering and pounding, and he put it on. The kind of work they were doing didn't sound at all like ductwork. What they had to do now was plant eyes and picture transmitters so they could not be seen or detected. They attacked the lead glass dome and bored bullet holes in it in the exact right places, getting around the problem of their being covered by the blinds if drawn. The very top of one of these upper-level domes was much more thickly tinted than the sides, so the detectors, readers, Care called them, had to be up pretty high. The bullet holes also had to be starred out, which is to say, given hairline cracks to make it look like they had come in from the outside. For good measure, they put some in other domes and didn't repair them, so that the condition appeared more general than in just Turl's quarters. They sank readers and transmitters into the holes. Then they repaired the holes with one-way see-through bubble patch. They put more glass repair sealing roughly on the cracks. Each reader had a leaded iris in front of it and was in a little lead box. The result looked like a crudely repaired hole fixed up in slovenly fashion by careless workmen. Each of these was focused on a different part of the work areas in the two rooms.
"He won't fool with that," grinned Care. "He'll be afraid he'll let his breathe gas out and air in."
It was afternoon by the time they completed the dome readers. They tested them with the probe and receivers. They went blind and undetectable with the probe on, and read everything in their path with the scope off. They took a short lunch break and turned off the disc that had been blasting in their ears. There was suddenly more din outside. Care went to the door and unbarred it. Lars got a whiff of breathe gas and backed up. He demanded Care to come out and talk to him right now.
"You're interrupting our work," said Care,
but he went out in the hall.
"You've got your nerve," said Lars, quivering with rage. "You gave me a handful of junk that had radioactive dust on it. You got me in trouble. When I showed it to Turl this morning, it started to explode when it got near his breathe mask. You knew it would. He almost bit me." "All right, all right, all right," said Care. "We will clean up everything in here before we turn on any big amount of breathe gas." "Those were radioactive bullets," shouted Lars. "All right," said Care. "They came in through the dome. We'll find them all. Don't get so excited." "Trying to get me in trouble?" said Lars. "You stay out of here," said Care. "It rots human bones, you know."
Lars didn't know. He backed up. He left. Angus said when Care had come back in and barred the door,
"Were they really radioactive bullets?"
Care laughed and began to shove goo food in his mask. Johnny marveled. Care was the only cyclo he had ever seen that could chew kerbango with a mask on, and now he was eating goo food and talking with the mask on.
"It was flitter," said Care, laughing. "It's a compound that throws off blue sparks when sunlight hits it. I dusted some of it on the bullets. Harmless. A kid's toy."
He was laughing even harder. Then he sighed.
"We had to explain the bullet holes, so we had to find some bullets. But that Turl, he is so clever that he sometimes can be awful dumb."
Johnny and Angus laughed with him. They could imagine Turl seeing the sparks when Lars held out the finds Care had given him, and the sunlight setting off the blue sparks. Turl's conviction that the world was after him must have driven him halfway through the back wall of the cage. He would have thought his own breathe mask exhaust was setting off uranium. They were into the ductwork now, and they really did start hammering and pounding. The trick was to set lead-irised readers into the duct vent intakes and exhausts around the room so that they could not be seen and yet, peering out of the dark depths of the vents, could read an exact portion of the workrooms. The ducts actually required some very fancy work of their own. Although Care was a midget, he could bend sheet iron with his paws like it was paper, Care fixed it so the ducts, as they entered and left the room, were rickety. If you touched them, they appeared to be in danger of coming apart and falling out. But in actual fact, the final fittings were armor-welded. They set the readers into these, made sure the irises worked, put the ducts in place, and began on the circulator pumps. It was late evening by this time, but they worked straight on through. By about 1 a.m, they had completed a usable circulator system that would go on working. They felt they were running behind in time, so they didn't stop. They had the problem now of centralizing the transmissions of all the readers and getting them clear over to the academy, miles away. None of these readers could be powered and picked up from more than a few hundred feet away. They all had different frequencies to keep them apart, and this meant a bulky feeder system. Johnny worked on the probe some more and put an on-off remote in it that would turn off and on the multi-channeled feeder box. That was the easiest part. One mustn't have radio waves flying about with a probe on. The tough part of it was getting the transmission through to the academy. They solved it by using ground waves. Ground waves differ from air waves in that they can travel only through the ground. The aerial to send is a rod driven in the earth, and the aerial to receive is simply another. It takes a different wavelength band, so there was no danger of anything detecting it. Since ground waves were not in general use by the Earth's cyclos, it required a feverish fabrication of components converting normal radio to ground wave. It was the fall of the year, and it was still dark when Angus and Care went screeching off to the academy to install the receivers and recorders, one unit in a toilet, one in an unused telephone box, and the third under a loose tile in front of the altar in the chapel. Johnny, meanwhile, buried the feeder outside the dome in the ground. He had the pretext ready of looking for power cables, but he didn't need it. The world slept. He shoved in fuel cartridges to run it for half a year or more, wrapped it in waterproofing, buried it in the hole, pounded in the ground aerial, and restored the turf. Nobody could detect the grass had even been touched. A hunter's skill in making deadfalls came in handy. Inside again, he checked. Every lead iris was working flawlessly. The readers were powered. They went on and off at the feeder. He let them run to give Angus and Care a signal to set their recorders to over at the academy. Johnny busied himself with placing and armor-welding the desks and drawing board in place. No molecular cutter would ever dent those welds. At 8 o'clock, Angus and Care sauntered in, as though just arriving for the day. They bolted the door, and both turned huge grins on Johnny.
"It works," said Angus. "We watched you laboring away, and even read the serial number on your welding torch. We got all 15 readers on the screen." He thrust out his hand. "And here's the discs."
They replayed them. They could even see the grain in material, much less read numbers. They heaved a sigh of relief. Then Angus took Johnny by the shoulder and pointed toward the door.
"We needed your skill and ideas up to now. But from here on, it's just putting cream on the oatmeal to convince Turtle. Every minute you stay here is a minute too long."
Care was already putting the rigged probe back in exactly the same place, arranging the cabinet just as it had been.
"When I took on this job and suspected you'd be coming," he said as he worked, "I fueled a plane. It's the one exactly opposite the hangar door. 93 is the last of its serial numbers. All waiting for you. They don't want us. They want you."
"It will take us only 45 minutes or an hour to rig the rest," said Angus. "You get out of here, and that's an order from Sir Robert to get you gone the moment you can leave."
Care now had relocked the door of the cabinet and was prying at the corner with a jimmy to make it appear it had been unsuccessfully tampered with without being opened.
"Goodbye," he said emphatically.
Yes, it was true. They could handle the rest and were in no danger. But it was also true that it had to be completed. He would get ready and stand by in the plane.
"Come down and tell me when it's all done," he said.
"You go," said Angus.
Johnny gave them a salute and went out. They locked the door behind him. He went down the passage to Char's room to get his kit. It was 8:23 in the morning, already 2 hours too late. 3. By 5 o'clock that morning, Brown Limper's staffer knew he had found Tyler. For days now, he had been unable to sleep, or even sit down quietly or eat. Forgotten were all other cares of state. Forgotten were all other tasks that ordinarily occupied his time. With a wild, intent glare in his eyes, for nearly 24 hours a day, he had concentrated only upon closing the trap which had been set. Crime must be punished. A malefactor must be brought to book. The safety and integrity of the state must be given priority. Almost every text he had studied on government, all advice he had been given, proved to him only one thing. He had to get Tyler. Victory had begun to beckon with a drone picture he took off the machine at 3 a.m. He had trouble with these machines. Ever since these recorders had been moved to the Capitol, he had been irritated by their incomprehensible complexity, and he often hit them when they failed to spit out what was wanted. It made him feel martyred having to do all this work with so little help. But he had been scanning the tray of drone takes that were rolling out from Scotland. The pilot who handled drone control and these machines was not here at this time of day. A nuisance. And there was Tyler, dancing one of those insane prances the Highlanders did, by bonfire with half a dozen others. Although the pictures were silent, a pain went through his ears as he imagined the crazy pipe music that must have been playing. Yes, hunting shirt and all, it was Tyler. The machine gave him a lot of trouble trying to backtrack its trace. He never could tell one cyclo number from another. But he managed it and got a blown-up view. It wasn't Tyler. He realized then he was not being logical. Tyler would not be dancing and flinging his arms about. The last time he had seen him down at the compound, Tyler had been limping heavily on a cane and had no use of his right arm. But at 4:48 a.m., a picture from another drone, then overflying the Lake Victoria area, spewed out and showed a man by the lake throwing rocks in the water. A man with a hunting shirt, same hair, same beard. Tyler. But it couldn't be Tyler because he was using his right arm to throw, and as he drew back, it was obvious he had no limp. He had no more than thrown the pictures down on the floor when Lars Thorensen rushed in as though he had news. Brown Limper let him have it, but good. What were two Tylers doing visible on two different drones in such a short time apart, yet so widely separated on the Earth's surface? "That's what I'm trying to say," cried Lars. "There are three Scots who look like Tyler, but that isn't it. You know what Turl told us to look for? Scars on Tyler's neck from the collar he wore so long. I couldn't understand why Stormalong was wearing his scarf so high around his neck. He never did before. And just 5 minutes ago, I woke up with the whole thing plain as daylight. He's hiding those scars. Tyler is down in that compound right now posing as Stam Stavanger. Stormalong." For all the wrong reasons, they had reached the right conclusions. Brown Limper went into immediate action. Time and time again, Lars had told him about this great military hero, Hitler, and his faultless campaigns. Turl had impressed foresight upon him. He had been ready for this moment. 2 days before, he had finalized the contract with General Smith. 100 credits a day per man was a lot to pay, but Smith was worth it. Two commandos had gone by truck to the village in the high meadow. There was no town meeting. The villagers had been swept up regardless of any protest. They had been hastily relocated in the distant village on the other side of the mountain Tyler had once chosen for them. The 5 youths who might have said something were at the academy, 3 of them learning machine operation and how to keep the passes open in winter with blade scrapers, the other 2 learning to be pilots. Old people and young children didn't have to be listened to, and their pleas that their preparations for the coming winter were now ruined could be ignored. As a concession to political sagacity, they had been told they were being moved so the old tactical mines could be dug up and disposed of. These mines... they knew now that they were explosives buried long ago, and Brown Limper had shown them this was just another instance of Tyler's lies, had their own role to play in this clever strategy. Tyler's old home had then been booby-trapped with grenades and blasting caps, and Brown Limper had been assured by the Brigante explosive experts that all Tyler would have to do was open a door and he would be blown to bits. The story would be that Tyler had gone to his house despite warnings about the old mines, and that one had blown up. In this way, there could not possibly be any outcry or blame attached to Brown Limper. The senior mayor Planet was a bit hazy on whether this had been his own idea or Turl's. But no matter, it was brilliant political thinking. The state and nation must be freed of the scourge, the arch-criminal Tyler, and with a minimum of repercussion to the body politic. Also, Brown Limper had read someplace that the end justifies the means, and this seemed to be a sound basic policy. Brown Limper realized, when he thought about it, that he was becoming a statesman ranked with the most stellar figures of ancient man. At 6 a.m., he ordered General Smith to begin changing the guard at the compound. The cadets were to be permanently relieved on the grounds they didn't like the duty and it interrupted their studies, and the state now had a proper standing army. Brigantes were to be on guard duty there by 8 a.m. A hasty call had ascertained that the other two, with Storm along, had left some time ago for the academy, and it was so logged by the duty officer at the compound. Thompson submachine guns had been issued to the Brigante commando. Somehow, assault rifles were not available, but Thompson's were all right for this duty. Lars had been briefed. He had been given 2 picked men armed with submachine guns. He was to go to the compound. He was to lie in wait, inside, until Storm along appeared, and then, with a minimum of disturbance, was to take him in custody. Lars was to bring him here to the courtroom. He was not to alarm Tyler into combat. When Tyler had been formally charged, he would be told his case would be tried by the World Court, to be formed in a couple of weeks, and then taken to the old village. House arrest and awaiting trial were terms Brown Limper had looked up. He would inform Tyler that he was under house arrest. Then it was up to Lars to get him to the meadow. There must be no chance taken of alerting cadets or some Russians holding out at the old tomb. Lars had said, "I think I should grab him while he's still in Turl's office." Brown Limper said, "No. Turl has assured me that he can undo any mischief Tyler may get up to if he gets in the office. He has probably remained behind to do something criminal after the others finished. You want to take him alone. The other two might help him. We are after the criminal Tyler. We must get him here smoothly, charge him, and get him up to the meadow. Be polite. Grant any ordinary request. Be smooth. Cause no disturbance. And don't damage the office. That is a request Turl made." It all seemed a bit muddy and out of sequence to Lars in the briefing, but he got the essential points. He got his 2 Brigantes, made sure they had their submachine guns, got an executive armored ground car, and left. Brown Limper told General Smith, "Keep your mercenaries out of sight at the compound, but be alert for trouble this morning. Tell them not to start shooting unless they are attacked." General Smith got it. His men were ready to earn their pay. Brown Limper had found the pattern of judicial robes judges used to wear, and he had one made for this occasion. He got into it, hopping over to the window and looking out between times, and finally gazed at himself in an old cracked mirror. The time of reckoning for a lifetime of abuse and insult was at hand. 4. Johnny strode 2 paces inside the door of Char's room, the muzzle of a submachine gun jammed into his left side. A Brigante rose from behind a chair, holding another Thompson grimly leveled. Lars stood up from behind the bed, a blast pistol pointing at him.
"We are not here to kill you," said Lars.
He had worked this entire campaign out and added a few embellishments of his own. From all he had heard, this was a treacherous and dangerous criminal liable to do anything. To carry out his principal orders, it was necessary to be very intelligent about this, as intelligent as Hitler would have been. "Just do as we request, and no harm will come to you. This is an entirely legal proceeding. You are under arrest by order of the council, and these are council troops." Johnny, as he entered, had been in the act of removing his air mask, or he would have smelled the badly tanned skins and body stench of a Brigante. An hour. Angus and Care required an hour to put the vital finishing touches on that office. These creatures might go up to the office and might even have arrest orders for them. He would buy Angus and Care that hour. He realized then that Lars and these two Brigantes had been here for a while. Care, when Johnny asked for work clothes, had simply bundled up all of Stormalong's gear. It had been in a neat kit by the bed. Now it was strewn about, thoroughly searched. The food bags from both Africa and the Academy were there. They had also been ransacked. Angus's gear had been very slight, and he had his tool bag with him, so there was no trace that two men's gear was in this pile. The Brigante behind him, with a glance at his mate to see that the action was covered, whisked the blast pistol out of Johnny's belt. Johnny shrugged. By time. And you are taking me somewhere?
You are to appear this morning before the council to be charged, said Lars.
Johnny casually swung the door shut behind him, closing out any view of the corridor. Angus and Care would not come out that way to go to the hangar, but they might make some noise. And worse, might foolishly abandon what they were doing and take these fellows on.
I haven't had anything to eat since yesterday, said Johnny. Do you mind if I have a bite first?
Lars stepped back to the wall. The Brigante behind him backed away. The one behind the chair stepped to another position, and Johnny collected up the food bag contents and water gourds and sorted them out. He sat down and drank some water out of a gourd. There were some bananas there, and he broke some off the small bunch. The Brigantes hadn't seen any bananas since leaving Africa and eyed them. Johnny offered them some, and they would have taken them, except that Lars barked a reprimand and they quickly snapped back to military duties. Johnny ate a banana. Then he found some millet bread and made himself a sandwich from local beef. He had quite a hard time selecting the exact right slices. The huge Cyclo wristwatch on his wrist was whirring off the seconds and minutes. He had marked it for the hour.
"What are these charges all about?" said Johnny.
Lars smiled very thinly. He was being pumped for confidential council information.
"You will be told in the proper time by the proper people."
Johnny finished the sandwich and found some wild berries. He ate these. The wristwatch whirred along. 49 minutes to go. He looked into the food bags and discovered some wild sugar cane from Africa. He peeled it with care and chewed on it, sipping from the gourd between times. Then it occurred to him, if they were all silent, Angus or Care might come bursting in here to see whether he was gone. Angus would suppose Johnny had taken his kit to the plane, but still, they might just come barging in and get arrested or shot. Very shortly now, he had better start this Lars talking, so they would hear a strange voice in here. 42 minutes to go.
"You sure messed up my clothes," said Johnny. "I'll have to repack."
But Lars was intent on something else. He wanted a real double check on identity, and in his haste he had forgotten it. He wanted to make doubly sure about the collar scars. He became clever. A military maneuver was needed here. He didn't want this Tyler to be able to seize a Brigante and use him as a shield. Right now, the collar of the work jacket covered his neck.
"There is no idea of inconveniencing you," said Lars. "You are in your work clothes, and I should think you would want to appear at your best before such an august body as the Council. You can change your clothes if you wish. We've removed all knives and weapons, so go ahead."
Johnny had smiled wryly when august body of the council was mentioned. What pomposity! But he said,
"Oh, well, in that case, I suppose I had better."
He began to sort the scattered clothes into piles, making noise. It would be better if he could keep Lars talking. 39 minutes to go. Care certainly had brought all of Stormalong's kit. He folded it all neatly and then began packing up items and looking at them critically as though deciding which he should wear, saying, "Would this do?" And, "How about this?" And, "How do they ordinarily dress when appearing before the council?" "In something like this?" He got Lars advising him. The council was very formal, very strict and mindful of its dignity, and its power was enormous, and men were expected to realize it. 28 minutes to go.
Johnny suddenly saw that Stormalong, who was always very neat as well as a bit dashing about clothes, had preserved the costume he had been issued in load days to look like Johnny. Chrissy had made several sets, pushed into it by Johnny, to take her mind off her imprisonment, and Johnny had handed out sets to Dunnell Dean, Thor, and Stormalong to improve their duplication. He unwrapped the buckskin hunting shirt and breeches and belt. Yes, even the moccasins. 23 minutes to go. Johnny took off his jacket, intending to sponge off a bit before dressing. Lars leaned forward eagerly. Turl had told him that a good security chief always depended upon body marks for identification. How right. There were the small scars of the collar. He had his man. He became inwardly jubilant, cheerful.
"You can hurry it along now, Tyler," said Lars. "I know you for sure. The collar scars."
So that's what he had been looking for, thought Johnny.
"The others left hours ago, didn't they?" said Lars.
"Well, yes, as a matter of fact, they did," said Johnny. It came to him that the others had been logged out when they went to the academy to install the recorders, and must not have been logged back in. Great. 20 minutes to go.
"And you stayed behind to rig some little tricks of your own, didn't you?" said Lars. "We'll find them later, never fear. Your masquerade is over, Tyler."
Lars thought that was pretty good. He had thought it up himself.
"Get dressed."
Johnny took a piece of buckskin and gave himself a sponge bath, a procedure looked upon with total amazement by the Brigantes. They had never seen nor heard of anyone ever taking a bath.
"How did you get on to me?" asked Johnny. "I'm afraid," said Lars, that is a state secret."
"Ah," said Johnny. 17 minutes to go. "Something you learned from Hitter or Bitter or whomever that was?"
He recalled Kerr mentioning this fellow was crazy on the subject. "You mean Hitler," corrected Lars angrily.
"Ah, Hitler," said Johnny. "That doesn't sound like a cyclo name. Cyclo names aren't two syllables, usually. Sometimes they are, though."
"Hitler was not a cyclo," said Lars emphatically. "He was a man. He was the greatest military leader and the holiest church member man ever had."
"Must have been a long time ago," said Johnny. 15 minutes and 17 seconds to go. They were almost in the clear for their 45 minutes. But it could be an hour.
"Well, yes," said Lars. "It was a long time ago."
"How'd Lars ever find out about Hitler?"
"Well, his family was from Sweden, and they were very literate. In fact, his father was a minister. And they had some old books the church had kept that had been printed by the German War Propaganda Ministry, in the purest Swedish, and it really was inspirational. It seems that to be really religious, one had to be a pure Aryan, and an Aryan was really a Swede.
Most people in the tribe had the colossal nerve to scoff at such holy creeds, but it had been the state religion of Sweden."
"I wish I'd heard about him sooner," said Johnny.
12 minutes and 7 seconds to go. "Was he really a great leader?"
"Oh, indeed he was, make no mistake about that. Hitler had conquered the whole world and enforced racial purity. You should really read those books. They are truly marvelous."
"Oh, you can't read Swedish? Well, I could read them to you."
"What's some parts of them?"
"Oh, well, it would take weeks to cover it all. But, for instance, there's a part of a book called Mein Kampf that outlines the whole destiny of the race. You see, there are really supermen and just plain men, and to be a superman, one has to study and know the religious creed of fascism."
"Did they worship God?" said Johnny.
7 minutes and 12 seconds to go. He began to dress, taking care with the thongs.
"Well, of course. God's real name was Der Führer, but Hitler had taken his place on Earth to make a world of peace and goodwill. Now, Napoleon was also a military leader, and before him was Caesar, and before him was Alexander the Great, and before him was Attila the Hun. But these men were not holy. One really had to know history to tell the difference. Now, even though Napoleon was a great military leader, on many points he didn't favorably compare with Hitler. Even though Napoleon had conquered Russia, he did not show the finesse Hitler showed when he conquered Russia. Now, all this was very ancient and a long time ago, and man had come to grief since, though not through any fault of Hitler's. So it was obvious that if man were to rise and be great again, they should follow the creed of religious fascism. And who knew but what some new Hitler might arise to bring peace on earth and goodwill toward men like Hitler had. It's a funny thing, you know, but his mother used to say, when she looked at the old pictures, that he, Lars, quite closely resembled. The distant roar of a car starting up, the snarl of its going around the ramps to exit, the unmistakable mad driving of care. They were gone. Johnny finished dressing, packed the kit, especially Stormalong's favorite coat and scarf and goggles, and bundled it all up.
"You will be sure this gets to Stormalong," said Johnny. But as Lars said nothing, Johnny decided to take it along. They had done it. How he would get himself out of this mess, he didn't know. He was a little puzzled as to why the other two had driven off when the battle plane must still be down there. But he was grateful they were out of it. "Let's go," he said. 5. They exited from a different ground-level door, one that was usually locked. Johnny glanced around for a cadet to give Stormalong's kit to and saw no one. "I'll see that it's taken to the academy," said Lars, divining his purpose. He must not see too deeply into the dispositions Lars had made, most of which prevented them from being seen by anyone, lest Lars find himself with a battle on his hands from cadets or Russians, some of whom had just arrived at the underground base in the mountains and were a considerable force. A storm was coming in from over the mountains, rolling black clouds studded with lightning around the distant high peak. The wind was picking up and bending the tall brown grass. A few dead leaves fled through the air. Autumn was here. There was a chill in the air on this mile-high plateau. It gave Johnny an eerie feeling, almost a premonition. He had left Africa in a storm, and here was a storm again. He threw the kit in the back and got in. The windows were darkened so no one could see in. With submachine guns trained upon him, they drove toward the capital. Lars was a bad driver, and Johnny could see how he must have gotten the cracked neck the plaster cast advertised. Johnny despised him. Johnny had known lots of Swedes, and they were good people. He had even gathered from Lars's conversation that they despised him, too. The man tried to chatter on about the ancient military leader, but Johnny had had enough. "Shut up," he said from the back. "You're nothing but a turncoat traitor. I don't see how you can stand yourself, so shut up." It was unwise, but he couldn't go on listening to this insanity. Lars shut up, but his eyes slitted. He suddenly enjoyed the fact that this criminal would be dead in a few hours. The ground car squatted down at a side entrance to the capital never used. There were no people to be seen. There were no people in the corridor either. Lars had seen to that. They thrust him toward a door. Unseen brigantes in the shadows kept their guns trained upon him. Two more were in the courtroom in the corners, Thompson's cocked and ready. And there sat Brown Limper. He was at a high desk on a dais. He was in a black robe. Ancient law books flanked him on either side. His face had an unhealthy sheen. His eyes were too bright. He loomed like a vulture about to attack a corpse. Just himself, the Brigante guards, and this Tyler in an otherwise empty room. It was Tyler. He had recognized that the moment the fellow strode through the door. There was an air about this Tyler one couldn't miss. He had hated it since they were children. Hated that easy, confident walk. Hated that set of even features. Hated those light blue eyes. He had hated everything Tyler was and he could never be. But who had the power now? He, Brown Limper. How he had daydreamed of this moment. "Tyler," said Brown Limper, "come stand in front of the court bench. Answer me. Is your name Johnny Goodboy Tyler?" Brown Limper had a recorder running. Such proceedings must be regular and legal. Johnny came to a board stand in front of the bench. "What is this farce, Brown Limper? You know my name well enough." "Silence," said Brown Limper, hoping his voice was resonant and deep. "The prisoner will answer correctly and properly, or become guilty of contempt of court." "I see no court," said Johnny. "What are you doing in that funny dress?"
"Tyler, I am adding contempt of court to these charges."
"Add what you please," said Johnny, bored with it.
"You will not consider this lightly when I read you what you are charged with. This, at present, is just a hearing. In a week or two, a world court will be established and the trial will take place at that time. But as a felon and criminal, you have the right to hear the charges so that you can organize your defense when tried. Now, hear ye, hear ye. You are charged with a count of murder in the first degree, the victims being the Champco brothers, loyal employees of the state, feloniously assaulted with intent to kill and later dying by their own hand due to pain of their wounds. Kidnapping in the first degree, the said Tyler assaulting and feloniously seizing the persons of two coordinators going about their legal duties as agents of the council. Murder and felonious assault upon a peace-loving and unoffending tribe called the Brigantes, including the slaughter of half a commando. Massacre of a convoy of peaceful commercial people going about their business and viciously and maliciously slaughtering them to the last man.
Cyclos, said Johnny. They were cyclos organizing an attack upon this capital.
That's stricken from the records, said Brown Limper.
Indeed, he would have to erase it from this disc.
You are not on trial. These are just the charges that have been brought against you by decent and deserving citizens of this planet. Remain silent and hear the charges.
It is noted by the court, continued Brown Limper, how he had slaved over this parlance from ancient books. He hoped he had it all right and legal.
That numerous other charges could be brought, but at this time have not been brought.
Such as, said Johnny, indifferent to this clown.
When you seized the remote control panel from one Turl and launched the drone against man, it has also been stated that you then and thereupon shot down said Turl when he was in the act of trying to shoot down the drone. However, there being witnesses, undoubtedly perjured and extorted by you to speak false testimony, who speak otherwise, the charges have not been included at this time, though of course they may be brought at some later date.
So that's all you could come up with, said Johnny, with irony. Nothing about stealing baby's milk? I'm surprised.
You won't be so arrogant when you hear the rest of this, threatened Brown Limper. I am an impartial judge, and this is a legal and impartial court. In the interim time pending your trial, you are forbidden to use any more of council property, such as planes, cars, houses, equipment, or tools.
Brown Limper had him. Quick as a flash, he pulled out the bill of sale of the Earth branch of the Intergalactic Mining Company and thrust it at Tyler. Tyler took it and looked at it. For a sum of 2 billion credits, one Turl, duly authorized representative of the Party of the First Part, which shall hereafter be called the Party of the First Part, did hereby convey all lands, mines, mine sites, compounds, planes, tools, machinery, cars, tanks, on and on, to the Council of Earth, the duly elected and authorized government of said planet, to have and to hold forever and from this day forward. It was signed Turl, but Johnny, who knew Turl's signature, saw that it must have been written with the wrong paw. He started to put it in his pouch.
No, no! Shouted Brown Limper. That is the original.
He fussed around in the papers on his desk and handed over a copy and exchanged it for the original. Johnny put the copy in his pouch.
And not only that, said Brown Limper, the whole planet was the property of Intergalactic, and there is a deed for that as well.
He started to hand over the original, thought better of it, found a copy, and handed it over. Johnny glanced at it. Turl had actually sold these fools their planet.
The deeds are valid, said Brown Limper pompously. That is, they will be when fully recorded.
Where? Said Johnny.
On Cyclo, of course, said Brown Limper. Out of the goodness of his heart and in spite of the trouble, Turl himself will take these deeds there and get them fully recorded.
When? Said Johnny.
Just as soon as he can rebuild the apparatus you feloniously and maliciously destroyed, Tyler.
And he's taking the money with him?
Of course. He has to turn it into his company. He is an honest man.
Cyclo, corrected Johnny.
Cyclo, corrected Brown Limper, and then instantly became furious with himself for permitting this judicial proceeding to assume other than a judicial tone. So, therefore, said Brown Limper, reading, and as stated, notwithstanding, in accordance with the legal tribal rights of the said Johnny Goodboy Tyler, he is hereby placed under house arrest in his own home in the meadow, and is herewith and hereby not to quit said home and said vicinity until haled before a world court, duly to be constituted under the authority of the council, said council being duly elected and invested with the total authority of total government of earth. Hey, man.
He had thought the last religious note gave it style, and he now sat proudly on the bench.
So, unless the prisoner has some last request?
Johnny had been thinking hard and quickly. He had never before paid much attention to Brown Limper, and such malice, falsehood, and evil was a little surprising. There was a fueled battle plane in the hangar at the compound.
Yes, said Johnny, there is a request. If I am going to the meadow, I would like to pick up my horses first.
Those and your house are all the property you own now, so it is only fit that you do so. Out of courtesy and feelings for the rights of the prisoner, and possibly even out of a fatherly feeling for him as his own mayor, I grant request, so long as you go at once from there straight to the village in the meadow and into your house.
Johnny looked at him with contempt and strode from the room. Brown Limper, eyes over-bright, watched him go. That would be the end of Tyler. He let out a shuddering sigh. What a relief all this was. And how long sought? 20 years. No, this was not revenge. He had to do it. Duty demanded it. The peoples of Earth would now be wholly in good hands. His, Brown Limper's. He would do his very best for them, as he was doing now, despite the toil it cost him. 6. The incident that would later become known as the murder of Biddy McLeod, which would bring the planet toward war, cost many men their lives, and later become the subject of ballads, romances, and legend, began at noon that day with Biddy's unfortunate spotting of Johnny in the capital area of Denver. When the head of the Russian contingent had been given orders in Africa to close the American underground base, it was very plain to the Russians that neither they nor Johnny would thereafter be residents in America, which brought up the subject of horses. Horses were wealth to the Russians. They had developed a small herd of their own in America, and they were not going to abandon them. Biddy McLeod considered himself responsible for Johnny's horses. He informed Colonel Ivan in no uncertain terms that he must go along with them to bring back Johnny's horses. When objections were raised, he doggedly countered them. He was with the Russians, and he would be safe. The horses knew him. Windsplitter, Dancer, Old Pork, and Blodgett would be frightened on the long plane ride unless they had somebody soothing them they knew they could trust. After hours of this, Colonel Ivan gave in. The Russians, just before dawn of that day, had thoroughly closed the American underground base as well as the nuclear missile store. If anyone tried to get into them now who didn't know the way or have the keys, they would be blown to bits. Planes had been arranged for the return, any material they were taking back aboard was already loaded, and before dawn that day they had left the base in a small convoy of trucks and cars to do their last job, pick up the horses from the planes. The way from the base led through the ancient ruins of Denver, and few of the Russians had ever been there. Further, recently they had begun to get paid. They were going home, and they had sisters and wives and sweethearts, mothers and friends. A few tiny stores had opened lately in Denver, the proprietors from other places, the customers, the people of the world, making pilgrimages to the mine site. The goods were salvaged and repaired items from the ruins of sprawling cities, and even some new products of native tribes. Dresses, shoes, cloth, jewelry, utensils, souvenirs, and relics were the main stocks in trade. The stores were few and widely scattered. The Russians decided that since they were many hours early for their departure time that evening from the academy field, and since they did not favor sitting around in the grass waiting, they would spend a little shopping time in Denver. They had parked their vehicles near the Capitol, for there was much space there, and its dome could be seen from all around as a landmark and gotten back to easily. They had scattered out, each on his own errands. Biddy had been given a special guard, a strong, tough Russian who was a special friend of Biddy's, named Dmitry Tomlov. And Dmitry had been charged by Colonel Ivan to stay close to Biddy and not be careless, and to carry his assault rifle and magazine pouch wherever he went. So it seemed all right. Biddy and his guardian had found a little jewelry and trinket shop that had been opened by an old Swiss couple and their son. The old Swiss had found and repaired an engraving machine. He was also clever with repairing items found in ancient wrecked stores, where and when they had been overlooked by metal-hungry cyclos. The son was in a back room of the shop, recovering from trying to defend the store from being robbed by the Brigantes. It seemed the Brigantes would go around telling everyone they were police, and they carried clubs and would pick up anything that took their fancy and put it in their pockets. The council, when approached by the few people now in Denver, had admitted that, yes, the Brigantes were police, and that law and order was vital, and that it was a felony to resist police. Nobody really knew what police meant as a word, but they had come to realize it was something very bad. So the old Swiss had decided to move away, and a lot of his items were for sale at very low prices. The wife was waiting on Dmitry. He had lots of relatives, but his first purchase was a little silver-headed riding crop for Biddy. Although Biddy would have been aghast at the idea of hitting a horse, the crop looked very nice. It was about 2 feet long, about the length of a Brigante bow, although no one noticed this at the time. Despite all these very low prices, Biddy was having a rough time. He wanted something special for Patty. He thought he would be seeing her shortly. He looked and looked, helped by the old man. Also, Biddy did not have very much money with him. His pay was only 2 credits a week, whereas a soldier's was 1 credit a day. Pay had not been going on very long, so Biddy only had 4 credits, and the better items were as much as 10. Biddy's problems were also complicated by the limited command of English on the part of the Swiss people, who spoke a combination of German and French. The Russian was no help. He had practically no English, and nobody spoke Russian there, including Biddy. But they were making out with signs and count marks on scraps of wrapping paper and raised eyebrows and pointing fingers. At last, Biddy found it. It was a real gold-plated locket in the shape of a heart. It had a red rose, still bright red, inset on it. It opened, and you could put pictures inside, and it had had its hinge nicely repaired, and it had a thin chain. Also, it had enough space on the back to engrave something, and, yes, the old Swiss would be happy to engrave it. With 1 credit for the engraving, it all came to 6 credits. It was the very thing. But 6 credits. He only had 4. Well, the old Swiss was selling out, and when he saw the disappointment on Biddy's face, he relented and let him have it, with a box thrown in, all engraved, repolished, and ready to go. When given a card to put the message on so it could be copied, Biddy fell into more difficulty. What was he going to put on the back of the locket? Johnny and others had told him that he and Patty were far too young to get married, and that was true. So he couldn't put, "To my future wife," really, for people might smile, and this was no smiling matter. He didn't want simply to put, "To Patty, love Biddy," as the old Swiss seemed to be suggesting. The Russian was no help at all. Then he had it. "To Patty, my lady fair, Biddy." The old Swiss then said that was too long to fit on the back. So he had to come back, after all, to Patty, my future wife. The old Swiss counted that up and said he could fit that in. It wasn't too satisfactory and people might laugh, but he couldn't do any better, and the old Swiss set up his engraving machine and had at it. All this was taking time, and Biddy was getting edgy. He might miss the Russians, and after all, Johnny's horses were his job as squire, and that's why he had come over to America. He hopped from one foot to the other and pushed at them all to hurry. The Swiss finally finished and put the locket in a nice box and wrapped it in some old paper, and the Russian finally got all the things he wanted, and they paid it all up and went rushing out to get back to the trucks. It was a cold day. There had been a frost, and dead leaves were blowing about. A storm was rumbling over the mountains. It all seemed to tell Biddy to hurry. But when they got back to the trucks, the position of the sun, seen through scudding cloud, said it was only noon. There were no Russians returned. The guard got into the driver's seat of their cab and began to sort out the presents he had bought. Biddy, almost engulfed by the huge cyclo passenger seat, closed the window against the chill wind and dead flying leaves, and sat there impatiently twiddling his new riding crop and looking out the window, his eyes just above the level of the bottom, keeping watch for the rest of the Russians. From where he sat, he could see a side entrance to the Capitol building. There was a big executive ground car sitting there with blacked-out windows. Suddenly, he saw Sir Johnny. There he was, dressed as usual in buckskin, unmistakable. He walked out of the side entrance of the Capitol. The door of the executive ground car was swung open from inside, and Johnny got into it. Biddy scrambled to get down the window and shout. He got it open part way. He couldn't get it all the way down. Then somebody else came out of the Capitol, somebody dressed like a cadet, a plaster cast around his neck. This second person stopped and called back into the Capitol stairway, where somebody must have asked a question. The man in cadet clothes yelled back, "He's just going down to the compound first to pick up his horses." Then he, too, got into the ground car and it started up. Biddy was wild. He hadn't been able to get the window down and call to Sir Johnny. Get the horses? That was why he was here, what he'd come all the way to America to do. He tried to get his guard to just start up the truck and follow. But Biddy's command of Russian was not up to it. Gestures and motions and repeating the sense of what he was saying got no place. This Russian was not about to go after that executive ground car. He was here to wait for the rest of the contingent. But Biddy got him out of the cab, and they went sprinting around looking for the rest of the Russians. Minutes went by, and they couldn't find them. This ruined city was too big, too spread out, too filled with rubble. Suddenly they spotted one Russian. He was walking along the edge of a park by himself, eating some nuts he had bought. He was a man named Amir, and he had no reputation for being quick in the wits, although he was a nice fellow. Biddy reeled off the situation to him, using gestures and a Russian word he did know. Skoryeyi, meaning hurry up, and trying to get the man to understand he was to find the others and tell them to come along right away. He was not at all sure the man got it, for he looked blank, but the action was enough to convince Dmitri that it was now all right to follow the ground car, so they got back to the truck and the Russians started it up, and they went roaring out of the city to catch up to the vehicle Biddy had seen Johnny enter. 7. Lars Thorensen had taken every precaution. He had gone over it very carefully. If there was no public display of arms and guards, while making sure that this Tyler was thoroughly covered at all times by adequate weaponry, then no alert would go out and no misguided friends of this felon would come pouring around to rescue him. Lars had left guards in the car, had let no other Brigantes appear on the streets or openly in corridors, had sent word to the commando now posted at the compound to keep out of sight but ready, and not to shoot unless attacked. He had a little surprise for this Tyler at the compound, but all should go smoothly and well. He thought even Hitler would have approved of the tactical skills Lars was displaying. They would pick up the horses, drive up through the pass to the meadow, order this Tyler to go into his own house, and that would be that. The scourge and menace to the stability of the state would be ended, thoroughly and with no blame at all to the council. The day had gone gray. The sun was more and more overcast. The wind was picking up, and billows of dust and clouds of dead grass were running before the approaching storm. Lars's driving was not all that good to begin with, and gusts were buffeting the ground car, swerving it from already badly chosen courses. He was not driving